Hello there. Today is August 20th, 2023, and we're in Santa Barbara, California at about 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and we are at Don Ranney's house in Santa Barbara. My name is Wayne Ranney. I'm Don's son, and we're talking with Tom Sulpizio, who's been researching the June 30th, 1956 TWA United Airlines collision in Grand Canyon. My father, Don, was employed with the Civil Aeronautics Administration at the time of the crash at LAX Airport, and we're just trying to capture any remembrances that Don has of sort of working there in LAX at the time, and Tom Sulpizio will be conducting most of the interview, and we're going to begin right now, and Don, will you just say your name for the recording?
I'm Don Ranney.
Thank you. And Tom Sulpizio, would you say your name?
I'm Tom Sulpizio.
Okay, and here we go.
Okay. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Mr. Ranney, for the oral history interview. This is a program which is a rich tradition of the Grand Canyon Historical Society as well as the Park Service, and we've conducted, the Society has conducted dozens and dozens and dozens, I think it's up to like 300 or 400 interviews, which at some point we will create a transcript, but even an audio, will there be an audio file of this placed at the website with your permission? Some people don't want to give permission, but you can choose to have it posted. So I'm going to start off by, after Wayne's wonderful introduction, by asking, when were you born?
I was born in Pomona, California, in September 20, 1932.
And 1932 to 1956, you were 20. Then you would be. Were you 24 years? No, you were not quite 24. You were
23 years.
23 years old. Can you give us a little bit of your career from school through that time in mid-June or late June?
Yes. I graduated from Pomona High in 1951. And at the time, the Korean War was going on, and I was soon to be drafted, so I elected to join the Air Force. And I spent 4 years there and trained as a control tower operator, working at the air base, guiding the planes in and out. At the end of my 4 years in the service, I first worked for the phone company for a couple of months, and then I got a job with the CAA, Civil Aeronautics Administration, and as a trainee in the control center in Los Angeles. I lived in, Montclair, California at the time, and so I made a daily trip into Los Angeles to near the airport, and that was kind of an ordeal. But there weren't freeways then, so it made it even harder. But then I want to explain that I had not worked there very long when this accident happened as a trainee, and it so happens, and I hope I'm not going to have enough information for you to contribute a lot, but actually when the accident happened, it was my day off, and I think I was on the morning shift the next day after the accident, and it was pretty much, the chaos had subsided quite a bit, I would imagine, and there was really a shock still. It just didn't happen. Those things just didn't happen, and my experience, the controllers were, of course, they had to reroute a lot of stuff, and I don't know, there wasn't any, at that time, I don't believe any military action going on. We did not have a lot of radar at the time. It was all by radio communication. And then there was VOR, it's visual oral operation. And that was for the higher altitude, which was mostly military. The lower elevation, say 22,000 and below, that was where the commercials came in. And they operated strictly by radio communication, transferring from one center to another. And I can't remember. I think it was not in their, in LA's control at the time. I'm not clear on that.
I think it's been determined, Dad, that LA had passed them off already to either Salt Lake City or Albuquerque, possibly Needles at first, but
you're probably perfectly right. Yes.
Yeah, there is some indication from books that have been written that LAX had passed them off to the next station.
Either, yeah. Daggett or Needles.
Yeah.
Okay, Daggett or Needles. Yes. So, okay.
I'm actually holding an FAA publication in the 25th anniversary of the FAA in 1983, which I received from some people I knew at the FAA. And I'm going to share this with Don afterward, but I'm just pointing out for the interview that I'm holding the page, which is the first page of the article about this incident, which was one of the reasons why the FAA was eventually formed. From the CAA was then changed into the FAA.
Yes, that's correct.
So I'll show this to you afterward,
okay.
Mr. Runny.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Just because it takes too much time to show you it now. Well, you mentioned, I want to follow up on a couple items. You mentioned you were with the Air Force as a control tower operator. What Air Force base was that?
Well, I was at, I got my training at Keesler Air Force Base in Mississippi.
Oh, okay, outside of the region.
Biloxi, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I was stationed at Scott Air Force Base, in Belleville, Illinois, mm-hmm. right out of St. Louis. And my third tour was Korea.
Okay.
I was stationed at K-9 Air Base in Busan, Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And the Korean War was over just before I got there.
Mm.
Okay.
About a week before. And that was, after that, I went stationed at Norton Air Base San Bernardino.
San Bernardino, okay.
Yes. And that's where I ended up my 4 years.
When did you discharge from the Air Force?
Roughly? March 5th, 1956.
Oh, 56.
Oh, you know the day. March 5th.
You don't forget those days.
Wow. So, just as a matter of clarification, your son was born on July 1st, 1954.
55.
No.
54.
It was 54.
Yes.
You're right. So yes, I was in Korea.
I know that because of the fact that it's proximity to the accident date. But I was wondering, just for the interview, where was your son born? In Korea?
My son was born at March Air Force Base in Riverside.
Oh, in March? I was going to mention March, asking you if you had done a service in March.
Yes.
Okay.
My mother saved the receipt for the cost of my birth. And on July 1st, 1954, the Air Force charged my mother and father $3.25 for my birth. I still have the receipt.
When Very Brian good. Was born at Norton, the price had gone up to $12, I think.
And so again, you have two other sons and one daughter.
Yeah.
Okay, so we come to your trainee at L.A. Airport. I don't know if it was called LAX in those days, if they had assigned the three-digit, a three-letter symbol, but it was Los Angeles International Airport. And we've all seen the photos of the limited amount of terminals there were at that time. But you were a trainee. You said you worked between the Air Force and the CAA. You'd worked a couple of months for another organization?
Yeah, I worked for the phone company
for a couple of months. So that means you only started with the CAA like in May.
Yeah, that would be about right. That exact date I don't have.
That's okay. So my question is, did you know any of the crew that would come through there for the carriers, which at that time there was four or five carriers? Did you know any of the crew from, not for this flight that had the accident, but just in general, United, TWA, American,
Pan Am
was in business, and maybe one or two, like Air Canada was flying down here.
No, I didn't. Actually, the CAA center was away from the base, from the airport. It was at Firestone Avenue. No, Manchester Avenue.
That's Manchester Avenue is either Venice or Culver City or something like that.
Yeah. And it's...
So you weren't physically at the tower. The tower at the airport was manned with other CAA...
The tower was... I wanted to be a tower operator, but you have to go through the training to learn all of the airways and all that, the whole system, how it all works. So I got training in the control center, which was on
Manchester.
Yeah, Manchester.
And what was your career at the CAA? Could you tell our listeners about that progression that you went through, your evolution
I worked there 5 months, and I didn't make it past trainee.
So you worked almost to the end of 56.
Yes.
Did
I think
you stay in aviation after that that job?
No, I didn't. I didn't last there because I didn't like the center work. I wanted to really be in the tower, but so I looked for other work. I got a job closer to home.
You were living in Montclair. You stayed in Montclair. Then you didn't move from Montclair
That's correct.
So it was good that you stayed in Montclair, in effect, because you didn't have to make the commute out to.
There were some other things that made me stay there. My wife, my wife was very close to her family, which lived in Pomona also, and she didn't want to move to Los Angeles. And I didn't know how long I would be with the CAA. As I was a trainee and didn't know if I would make it. It's a very hard job, I'll tell you that. I watched those guys on the boards working, and
But what was your work? Enlighten us. What were you doing as a trainee?
Mostly. Filling out the flight strips and restocking.
I've seen the photos. We've all seen the photos of the flight strips.
Yeah, they're the little bars, and I didn't even get as far as taking the information from one center to the next, or you just get the flight. Well, you get the whole flight.
Right.
But you don't get all the final destination, which is Los Angeles, and how they get control from other centers And then the people here are relaying. It's a long process, but they read those little three-letter
abbreviations.
Abbreviations, and
airport codes.
Yeah.
Did somebody take your strips and with a car or vehicle move them over to the tower or the air traffic control?
No, there was a guy that actually took control of the planes, maybe at Needles, say, or the other one.
Needles or Barstow or something like that.
Yeah.
Daggett.
Control.
Yeah, that's a Omni thing.
Yes.
And, they would take over. And then there would be, they would bring the people in. And then that man would turn it over to the tower. Tower took it from there.
Because we've all seen pictures of the tower with the strips, the bars that are on a board that get constantly being moved.
Yeah, keep moving down.
They keep moving down. I don't have a photo of it in this article, but that I'm holding from the FAA, but I remember seeing photos of it. So getting back to your work, you weren't there on the 30th. When did you hear about this midair collision between two Los Angeles departed major aircraft? When did you first hear about it?
I don't recall, but I'm pretty sure that I knew when I got there, before I got there.
On July 1st. You went to work on July 1st, you said. June 30th, you were off.
Well, I don't know the date. It was
Saturday you were off.
Yeah.
The day, and you weren't there the day of the flights, but you had, your working day was the next day.
Yeah.
So you guys had to work weekends, obviously.
We did.
Yeah, and you've told me previously that you weren't working the day of the crash, but you had to begin your 10-day shift on July 1st.
See, I forgot it was a 10-day shift.
And okay. You told me you had 10 days on and 4 days off.
10-4.
Yeah. That's right.
On prior times.
Now I remember that.
Yeah. So your 10 days began on July 1st.
See, I'm very vague on a lot of this.
Well, that's why we're working with you to, I would say that I've talked to some other people from the 50s, and you have to let everyone, you have to kind of bring in triggers to help you with your memory, because not all of us remember every detail from 67 years ago.
Well, I also want to say that in the beginning, there was a lot of homework and studying. I wasn't always right there watching and doing that stuff. Mm-hmm. I was in classes and studying.
Okay.
There was a lot to study.
So,
two systems. There was the VAR and the IFR.
VFR, IFR.
Yeah. But all these flights are IFR. It doesn't matter. As far as I remember, you have to be VFR. You're kind of visual, and you're not under control.
Just to get back to Tom's question about when you may have first heard about it.
Right.
And you did say that when you went to work on July 1st that you were probably already aware of it. Back in June of 1956, was there something like the evening news on TV or possibly a radio broadcast where you might have heard about the crash, maybe that evening of the crash? Or it might be hard to remember.
Again, it was a Saturday.
It was a Saturday.
So it was a weekend.
We didn't have TV.
Yeah, you didn't have a TV then.
So,
I mean, were people calling each other up and say, "Did you hear the news?" Or
I can't.
Well, I have the LA Times from July 1st, and it was the front page story.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you got the LA Times, which, there were more newspapers in those days, but still, the LA Times was a preeminent newspaper in Los Angeles and Southern California.
They probably would have been getting the local Pomona paper.
You would have gotten the Pomona paper, and maybe the L.A. paper, maybe or maybe not, but certainly.
It was at night, wasn't it?
It happened in late morning, the accident, but it wasn't reported or observed. There were a couple of aircraft tour people that reportedly saw the smoke from the two collapse.
Oh.
The two collision, the two crash sites. Because remember, there was one mid-air collision, but then two crashes. Mm-hmm. There was one joint event, plus then a mile and a half apart from each other, the two crashes. So they could see the plume from the fuel and the burning, and that's how they then reported it in. I won't give you the details because other people know the details better than I, but it was reported in the afternoon of the 30th.
Late afternoon, but the people that work with the flights knew that they were missing. They were not responding to calls for them.
Yeah.
And within 20 minutes, the people working in towers and at these places where they keep track, they knew something was up, but it wasn't until the mid to late afternoon that a crash site had been identified and probably was these two commercial airliners. So it's possible you might not have heard about it until you showed up for work. I don't know.
Then Sunday, July 1st, what time would your shift begin typically? Was it a morning shift? Did you start in the morning?
Eight in the morning.
So when you walked in to your Manchester Avenue training center, do you have any recollection of the feeling of the moment? Not necessarily any details, but just the impression or the feeling that people may have expressed or shown on their faces?
No, I can't recall that. Okay. I can't remember.
All right. Fair enough. In the course of the next day or so, I mean, certainly at that point, later on the 1st and 2nd, surely you would have heard of it and knew about a little bit more about it by then.
Yeah.
And you weren't involved at all in any of the investigation or pulling together anything from the records there in Los Angeles? Mm-mm. Okay. I have to ask it as an interviewer.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say that your stint with the CAA, it would have been nice if you had stayed to when they formed the FAA, because I think the organization became more formalized, more structured, more scientific. You would have probably enjoyed working with them as the FAA. Actually, it was the Federal Aviation Agency initially, and then they changed the name in the 60s, the Federal Aviation Administration.
Yes, I remember that.
You would have enjoyed a career with them until Ronald Reagan would have fired you.
Come on. Oh, no, I was in...
He only fired the controllers.
Only the controllers.
I thought the controllers would go back to work.
Well, you replaced them. You replaced the striking controllers with some quickly trained controllers. We're lucky as a country, we probably had a few near misses and a few near accidents, but we didn't have anything tremendous. We didn't have catastrophic events. Let me just say, Wayne, is there any questions you would like to ask in the interview before we wrap up here?
Well, I think this crash loomed large in my mind when I was a ranger at Grand Canyon, and I got to look at the Kodachrome slide photographs when I was working as a ranger, and I recognized that this crash happened one day before my second birthday.
Right.
And somehow or another, I felt a connection to it. But the date of the crash was 20 years prior to when I was holding these Kodachrome slides up to the light and looking at them. And I remember thinking as a 21-year-old kid, wow, this crash happened 20 years ago. And thinking that was a long time, and of course now it's been 67 years.
Right.
It wasn't until I was visiting my father here in Santa Barbara 5 years ago that he mentioned to me that he worked for the CAA and that he was at the LAX complex. And I thought to myself, oh, I have a little bit closer connection to this than just stumbling onto it. And obviously you didn't work there long enough to keep that as a career, but we still wanted to capture anything at all that you had. I mean, you know, it might not shed a lot of light on it, but it must have been fairly traumatic to go into that office on July 1st and, you know, all those people just wondering, did we do anything wrong?
That's right.
Is there anything that we could have done at LAX to possibly do this? But, of course, they would have known, well, we'd already passed it off to Daggett or Needles, and that wasn't our thing. So maybe there was a sense of relief.
Just because the flights left, literally, they were both delayed by a little bit for different reasons, but they left within 2 or 3 minutes of each other, although they had different cruising speeds because they were different aircraft, and they did have different vectors or trajectories to what they call the Painted Desert line. The fact is that, according to this expert, Mike Nelson, who heads up the families group, according to his calculation, 1/20th of a second, and he and I have discussed this, if it's 1/20th or 1/50th, but it's a fraction of a second difference in leaving would have resulted in a near miss. 1/20th of a second difference in any starting point. Because you can't, and of course they would have to have had the exact same maneuvers in their trajectories over to the Grand Canyon. But that's literally the distance, because in 1/20th of a second, an aircraft traveling at 275 miles per hour, there would have been enough clearance of 20 or 30 feet, they would have had a near miss. Now, that's just to put into the perspective how rare an incident this was.
Yeah.
The idea that any one individual at the origin point could have changed it is not reasonable. The biggest investigations, because I was my family was a member of a lawsuit, we got a settlement from United. The biggest gaffes were the lack of communication between AirRink in Salt Lake City, and then the carriers. The pilots would communicate with their own carriers their position, which would then be reported to some radio organization. In the case of these two aircraft in Salt Lake City, there was no direct communication with the captain or the crew about the position of other aircraft. So it took a series of mid-air collisions. There was another one just about a year later in Las Vegas of a DC-7 with a jet from Nellis Air Force Base that resulted in another 55 people on the aircraft being killed. It took this sequence of constant crashes, mid-air collisions, which should be so low a probability, but they were happening way above the probability of what would be prudent. In fact, I've actually looked this up. Traveling in those days, in terms of accidents per 100,000 accidents per million miles, accidents per million passengers, you choose your metric, accidents per flight segment, it was somewhere between 60 to 100 times what it is today. Mm-hmm. Now, 60 to 100 times. That means it would have been, let's say, 100 times more likely to have an incident, fatal or non-fatal, in the 50s and 60s than in 2023. Wow. So clearly this is actually the speech I gave at the eulogy in June, on this past June 30th, to Keeble and his people, and it made it into their newsletter.
Yeah.
Clearly, we make technical progress as a society from these accidents, because we don't build in the safety systems we need to in the early days of any technology. Mm-hmm. There's an expression about and I can't remember if unfortunately I'm not going to try to butcher it, but it's about that progress is measured in the blood of humans. Mm-hmm. There's an expression related to that. So the CAA was a predecessor. It wasn't prepared for the kind of air travel that started to evolve in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. And the jet.
Well, the jets hadn't even emerged except with the Air Force. And a year later, there was a jet and DC-7 accident over Vegas.
While I was working there at the center, it's interesting, they had the first commercial jet test flight from Seattle to L.A.
Oh, that was interesting.
There was going to be the people at the center had to draw straws. 7 people got to go, and I was one of them.
Oh, you were on the
test. We got on that 707.
Good for you.
And then it was so small. But at that time, oh, man, this is something. The first commercial jet from Boeing.
Yeah, 707 is a Boeing aircraft.
Yeah.
You got to fly on it?
No,
just to get on it. Oh, look at it.
Yeah.
It was... And this came from Seattle.
I was a trainee. Those are the guys that have been there for years. They probably were crapping their pants.
So, Don, this was a 707 that Boeing brought down to Los Angeles Airport. They flew it down.
Yeah.
Their test pilots flew.
Yeah.
Okay. And you got to go on. You got to visit the aircraft.
Yeah, I got to go in and see it.
Well,
it sure looked like nice. The comfortable thing.
Yeah.
And I'd been on planes before.
Parenthetically, since we're very close to it, the Reagan Library and Air Force One exhibit is about 70 miles from here, 65, 70 miles from here. And Air Force One in the 80s was a 707.
Really?
The aircraft is a 707.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I've been through it. So if you guys have a chance, you might want to...
He's been there.
I'm sure you've been there. Okay. Well, if you like, that was a nice little add-on, so I'm glad we got into this discussion about the history of aviation. But it would have been nice if you, I'm sure you would have contributed to lowering that incident rate from the 100 times in the 50s to where it is today at 1.
Yeah.
And you could have been part of that. You chose another route, which is every bit your prerogative, and of course, believe me, I know what it's like dealing with commuting because I've made career decisions based on locations and commuting. And
it's more spectacular because there's more aircraft in the air now than there was then.
This would have been, if we had the same air control systems today, which would have been ludicrous given the progress of technology, I can't even imagine that could be in existence. It would have been absolutely, you would have thousands of fatalities every year.
I wouldn't on an airplane.
If you had 128 fatalities in one incident in June 30th, 1956, you'd have 100 times that today with the air travel that it's exploded. You'd have tens of thousands of people, and that wouldn't be tolerated.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Ronnie, for your...
I didn't contribute very much, but I was glad to do it.
No, Wayne invited me to do this, and I tried to study my interview mentor Tom Martin's work over the past few years. And now you join the illustrious group of 400. And Wayne, I'll let you collect this and decide where it should be, where the depository should be.
Yes, I'll send this to the oral history folks at Grand Canyon Historical Society.
Did you have and one final item is probably we need a release for the Historical Society.
We'll do the release, so.
Thank you both, and I wish you, as we say in Italian, cent'anni, 100 years. How about 200 years? I would say that with this, we'll conclude the interview.
Yes, thank you, Dad.
Thank you, Tom. And hope I helped a little.
Yeah, thank you very much. We wanted to capture it.
Every insight... If you want to shut that off, it's up to you. But one of the projects I've had has been to find of the 13 or 14 Southern California-based passengers for the United flight. I'm not an expert on the TWA passengers. I am on the United. I have been trying to find anyone that would have been would have been someone in their late single digits or a tween or an early teenager to see if they went to the terminal. That morning, I have found a couple of people who definitely went to the terminal. They have not, or at least there's highly suspected, but I have one right back to me that said she was like 4 years old. She didn't go to the terminal. So far, I haven't found anyone that would have gone, but even if they, the only would have been, if they had gone, would be if they took photos. Because mm-hmm. then if they took photos in the departure line, remember there was no TSA, there was no security clearance. You just had a ticket. Your loved ones saw you off. But that would have been exciting to me, and I think...